Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Puppet Masters and Castle Freaks, the internet's leading all things Charles Band podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jared Hornbeck, the podcast host who'd rather be watching Star Trek, honestly. But I am not here alone. No, I'm not. Who's here with me today?
Well, it is I, the fungus and silk PJ, Steve Guntley. And this is the podcast. It's all about singing trolls, swinging Sunny, and Elaine Bennis as a wood nymph. That's because this is the podcast about Troll, the 1986 creature feature from John Carl Beekler that has earned a long legacy in a lot of surprising ways. A lot of interesting stuff goes into this sort of seemingly marginal Gremlins knockoff. And I'm excited to be getting into it because we have a very cool guest joining us as well. Who's here with us today, Jared?
I'm super excited because I feel like it's the perfect fit for an episode like this for Troll. The guest that we got to join us today is an artist, author of graphic novels, notably Kitty Sweet Tooth, but also a lot of nonfiction books about Japan and Japanese culture. Abby Denson is here with us, and I've looked at your books, Abby, and they're so awesome. So I can't wait to hear what you have to say about Troll. I'm so excited that we have this overlap. What's going on?
Hi, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me. So I'm a fan of the podcast, so thanks for that.
Thank you. I'm excited
to talk about Troll. For me, it's actually kind of a recent discovery in fandom, so I have a fresh excitement about Troll.
So, Abby, we want to get into, your relationship with this movie, your relationship with horror movies in general, or B-movies, low-budget stuff. But before we get into all that, I think the listeners need to know that we are actually arch rivals. Now, we might be civil at this moment while we talk to each other here. But I'll let you describe what it is I'm talking about here. Where, if people are wandering around the West Village near the water on Christopher Street, can people find you one Monday night or Wednesday night a month?
Hi, so we've come together because of Final Exam Horror Trivia, which Ted Gagin and Michael Gingold have put on. It's been more than 4 years, quite a while now.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot, and it's expert level. It's really difficult. And I'm in the team member of Suspiria Wallpaper Fetish. That's our team name. And we've been
doing really well. That's a really good team name. Yeah, that's amazing.
Thank you. And we've been doing really, really well. So some people might be a little bitter towards Suspiria Wallpaper Fetish, but we are here in a, I think it's a more of a friendly rivalry.
Oh, sure.
No, it absolutely
is. That's not what Jared's been saying in our text threads about
you. Well, that's what I'm saying.
I don't want to stir the pot or anything, but,
On the air, on record, I'm saying it's a friendly rivalry. And we've actually had Eric Walkuski from your team on to talk about Dollman with us, and he'll be returning to the show in a couple of months as well for another really fun one. And so, it's you can't not have a friendly rivalry. I think with that trivia, everyone is just happy to be there, happy to show off a little bit, but also just to be in company of such nerds, because Abby mentioned it's expert level, and it's expert level. It is a tough game. And so, when they finish first or second, or we're always kind of we finish second to them, we're always kind of in the top three, kind of neck and neck.
Yeah.
It's nothing to sneeze at. Like, even finishing second in a game like that and answering, however many questions that we get right for the night, we always feel pretty good about ourselves. And then the best thing about it, and I think I mentioned this to Ted when we had him on a few weeks ago, is just if there's something that they bring up that I'm unfamiliar with, or a movie I haven't seen, or a question I get wrong, I jot it down. And then the next time I'm off, I go and I seek this movie out. So there's things that were blind spots for me that now I found them. And it's just the New York
resource
horror community is great. And everyone's super supportive.
It has actually been I know I've definitely made friends through it. So I have to give huge thanks and gratitude, seriously, to Ted and Michael for putting this on, because also through the pandemic, I have to, the friends I made do it got me through during the lockdowns. We were doing regular movie, people on my team do regular movie get-togethers and nights, which actually is how Troll came to me. So,
yeah.
Abby, do you have a long, horror movies and low budget movies and things like that? I mean, you're extremely knowledgeable. Did you start as a kid with this? Were you, as we like to say, a video store child?
Yes, actually, a lot of when you were all speaking in past episodes about the video store and the box art, but I actually wasn't into horror as a child. I too was a child who was afraid of certain box art. The one that I always think about is Evil Dead 2, the back of it, not the front, the back with the, you know, I think it was like, you know, the image of the hand, the bloody hand.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And as a little kid, that's really scared me. And I was, my stepbrother wanted to watch it. And I was like, no, it's too scary. Well, guess what was my favorite movie in my 20s? So it comes back around.
I think that's how it works. I think whatever the, well, maybe not, because Steve's movie would favorite movie with this to this day would be Child's Play 3. And I don't think that's the case.
Not
but I was
going to
say, sometimes the one that scars you is the one that ends up making the biggest imprint and then is your gateway into it.
It was intriguing, you know. Yeah. I think when you're intrigued by the fear of the art on the box and you eventually get to see it. And luckily, the movie that I was intrigued by was good.
Yeah, you got lucky on that one. Yeah, I think I talked about, yeah, Child's Play 3 was traumatized me when I was very young, and that's kind of my least favorite Child's Play movie.
Yeah, so I wasn't, I actually didn't start to go down into a horror journey till my early 20s, but I was like real, I was a Rocky Horror kid.
Mm.
So
yeah.
I was a B movie, weird movie, you know, queer cinema, since my early teens. And I actually was in the, I shadow cast as Magenta when I was in my teens.
Very nice.
So I was like a big Rocky Horror fan and Shock Treatment, of course, and all these other, I think I knew, you know, I really wanted to know more about underground cinema, cult cinema, things like Greg Araki's work, that kind of thing was what I was more starting out with. And so like, as I, to like weird movie, I like weird movies.
Yeah.
So, or underground. And then in my early 20s, I started kind of getting into the horror movies, and then I found more and more what I liked, which would be Suspirias, your Evil Dead 2s and things like that. And then, you know, as you know, with horror and B movies and even Charles Band movies, there's more and more to dig. And
yeah.
There's no shortage of stuff for us to dig through for this show. That spreadsheet appears endless.
Yeah, it spins off rapidly. I think there was briefly, to take it back to Troll a little bit, I think we were briefly having a discussion about, all right, do we just do an episode about Troll 2? It kind of falls outside of our purview, but it's related, and it's like this kind of monumental sort of bad movie, I think, that has completely overshadowed this movie in a lot of ways.
For sure.
At this point, like, everything that can be said about Troll 2 has been said, but not a lot has been said about Troll 1. So, and I think this movie is actually worth digging into a little bit, because it's weird in ways that are not related to the sequel in any ways. And it's interesting in ways that aren't related to that sequel in any ways. But we should also mention that this spawned a sequel, which is maybe the greatest bad movie ever made. I mean, if you are in the mood for just like a legendarily terrible, poorly acted, poorly directed, poor special effects, Troll 2 is a hoot from beginning to end. It is constantly surprising. It's constantly weird. They made an amazing documentary called Best Worst Movie.
So good.
Really makes a good argument for this and about the cult that's kind of arisen around Troll 2. It's kind of a beloved underground cult piece for a reason, but that doesn't mean you should sell the original Troll short. So let me jump in a little bit with some stats on this. So Troll was originally released January 17th, 1986, directed by our old buddy John Carl Beekler and written by Ed Neha and Oliver Gonzalez. And it stars Noah Hathaway, Michael Moriarty, Shelley Hack, Jenny Beck, Phil Fondacaro, Sonny Bono, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Brad Hall, and June Lockhart. Now, we have talked about this movie a little bit before when we talked about Terrorvision, because Terrorvision and Troll were both being shot at the Rome studio of Empire at the same time. John Carl Beekler is the director of this one, and he was the special effects master on Terrorvision. So when he would finish a day of shooting this movie, he would literally walk across to the next soundstage and work on special effects for Terrorvision. So he was pulling a lot of double duties back then. And this is the first feature-length film that John Carl Beekler has directed. Now, we talked about it briefly with the segment he directed for The Dungeon Master, which was the Rat Spit section. Rat Spit makes a cameo in this, incidentally. He's one of the trolls in this movie. But yeah, this is his first time working with a feature-length cast, and he really pulled together a pretty impressive cast for this little movie for his first feature.
It really is. It's like a stacked cast of not just these B character actors, but people who've done a lot of things across a lot of different genres.
Yeah.
Like, I think sometimes with a movie like this, maybe there's one standout, like when you're watching the first Ghoulies and you see Mariska Hargitay.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's like, oh, look how young she is. Look at her doing this first. And you get that a little bit with Julia Louis-Dreyfus here, but mm-hmm. the difference is that she's surrounded by really recognizable people and people who've worked within a number of genres for a very long time. Yeah. I have to say, show my cards immediately with this one. I think this movie is a ton of fun.
Yeah.
It's not one that I'm going to go back and revisit a whole bunch of times, only because it does lean more into that PG-13 fantasy type thing than it does into horror, which is by design. We'll talk in a little bit about how this the concept for this movie started and how it changed. But it's so much fun, and I love Michael Moriarty.
I knew he would be one of your guys. He's absolutely one of my guys too. If people have not seen his collaborations with Larry Cohen, specifically The Stuff and Cue the Winged Serpent, Michael Moriarty is so good in all of those. He has such a singularly weird energy. He looks very like milquetoasty. You know, he plays a lot of like businessmen, a lot of suburban dads, because that's what he looks like. But that is not the energy he gives off ever. He is not content to just be like boring button down dad. There's always something off about him. And that's very much the case with his character here, Harry Potter Senior. One of the other big things to talk about with this movie.
Oh, yeah. Sure. And you know, maybe this is appropriate for Mike, but I'm going to say it anyway. I have officially now seen a Harry Potter movie.
Hey, all right. Finally, welcome to the fold. You've seen one, and it has two Harry Potters in it. So
it's my favorite Harry Potter movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like our cultural conversation about around the property and its creator is drastically changing. So over the last few years, it's gotten way easier for me to say, oh, I never read a Harry Potter book, I never saw a Harry Potter movie, and people used to look at me or try to sell me on it, and they don't do that anymore. It's weird.
Yeah, people have the tide has shifted a little bit on that. But yeah, that is one of the things that's often mentioned in conjunction with this movie. This is the first appearance of that name, Harry Potter, and it seemed some early internet fanboys were maybe speculating a little bit, because this is about a teenage boy who's discovering a world of magic and wizards and witches and trolls, like in his backyard. Charles Band does not believe that J.K. Rowling stole this name. I don't believe it either. I think it's a coincidence. It's a common name. I just think it's kind of a funny coincidence that happened that way.
Agreed.
But playing the young Harry Potter here is Noah Hathaway, who really you might only know from one other film, and that's Atreyu in Neverending Story. And already puberty has hit him like 2 years later, and he's almost unrecognizable from Atreyu. He looks very, very different, unless like he's very still. Maybe it's just the lack of the floppy hair, but it took me a minute to realize who this kid was.
He looks a lot like what I imagine young Charles Band looked like.
I could imagine that, yeah.
He really does. Like when there's a lot of kind of close-ups or straight ahead shots of his face, and I was like, man, he actually kind of looks like Charles Band.
Yeah, no, he does a little bit. I mean, so we have him, we have Shelley Hack as his mother, who's a former Charlie's Angel. We of course have former musician, future congressman Sonny Bono in this movie playing the upstairs sleaze. We have of course we mentioned Julia Louis-Dreyfus in her film debut. Here, acting alongside the actor Brad Hall playing her spouse in this, is her real-life partner, has been for about 45 years now. They've been together this entire time. Julia Louis-Dreyfus says she did not have a good time on this movie. There is a clip, I think from 2013, 2013, 2012, somewhere around there, where she was on Leno and Leno broke out this clip and she was a little pissed about it because she's a little embarrassed by this movie. I don't think she needs to be, but you can understand if you've won as many Emmys and are as like revered as Julie Louis-Dreyfus, you don't necessarily want that footage of you dressed like a wood nymph and parading with a couple of like rat puppets, like circulating. You know, that's one of those things that could dig. I think she's committed. I think she's charming and funny. I think she shows a lot of the talent she's going to show later on. She doesn't have much of a role here, but like, I don't think she has anything to be embarrassed about here, but I understand where she's coming from. And then we have June Lockhart, the former mother to Lassie, who is playing the evil witch here. I think a fun bit of casting. And I was surprised going back to it this time. Now, I've seen Troll 2 maybe two dozen times, maybe, if I'm being conservative. You know, like, I break that thing out at bad movie parties all the time.
Sure.
And I've never really given this film much shrift. I'd watch this once because I just kind of wanted to be a completist and see what ties in and what doesn't. But I chose a weird double feature for watching this movie. Before I watch this one, I should also reveal right now that I'm a bit of a Disney animation nerd, and I don't know if that's ever really come out here, but I watched the new movie Wish, which was Disney's movie that they came out for their 100th anniversary, and it was soulless and drab and boring and confusing, and I was just waiting for it to end. And then I put on Troll and I'm like, oh yeah, this is batshit in the right ways. This is sprightly and it's fun and it's got a soul and it's got a sense of humor and it's like struggling against the limitations of its budget, but it's doing something weird and fun. And so I strongly preferred watching 1986's Troll to the latest $200 million Disney film. That's my hot take right there.
I mean, that's usually what I gravitate towards when given the choice, although I do quite like a lot of Disney animation. Maybe some of the stuff for the anniversary coming out now, a little less interesting to me. But you brought up June Lockhart, and I also think it should be noted, like, mom of Lassie, but also Lost in Space.
Oh, like, right. Lost in Space. I forgot about Lost
and
in
she,
Space.
Her career actually goes back, so far that she actually was a star in one of the like original movies of Universal Monsters run, She-Wolf of London.
Oh, she was
the titular She-Wolf in She-Wolf of London. Wow. But she's been one of those people who's done one episode appearances in like every television show imaginable from probably the late 60s, early 70s into the 90s. I mean, you know, she did like, what was the Las Vegas with Robert Urich and Hotel with James Brolin and those, you know, little one episodes on those for just about everything you could possibly imagine. And one thing that this movie does that I think is kind of cool that you don't see that much is when she at the end makes herself turn young, they cast Anne Lockhart, her daughter, to play the young version of her, which I thought is kind of fun because it looks her.
I did not put that guy. I looked at the names and the credits. I did not put that together at all.
Yeah, that was awesome. And I just like, I'm going to put my two cents in on the casting. I think she was stunning as June Lockhart and Anne Lockhart. I don't know. She has so much charisma, the close-ups on her, her makeup, her hair. And I just was mesmerized by how beautiful she was to me, even though, you know, it's not typical that. And I feel like she was actually the hero or heroine of the movie. And that's not so expected in an 80s movie where you have a young boy protagonist. You kind of think we're going to be going along with his adventure to be the hero. But to my mind, she was actually the main protagonist, the hero. And in the end, she's the one who basically, you know, got everything together to save everybody. And I was really kind of gobsmacked by that, that a movie in this era had such a protagonist of what's supposed to be an elderly lady, and her dialogue and her chemistry talking with all the other characters was great, and with Noah's character, with Harry Potter Jr., I thought was really great. She was kind of teasing him, giving him a hard time, you know, but lovingly, and
The character, her introduction is really funny because Noah Hathaway's character, and you know what? Sometimes we say that for convenience, there's no reason why I should not be able to remember Harry Potter Jr. off the top of my head.
Yeah.
So I'll say when Harry Potter Jr. walks into her apartment, they have a little back and forth where you're like, it's almost like if there wasn't the age difference, you would almost be like, are these two dating? Like, it's a weird little play off one another. And then he introduces himself. So it's like, oh no, they don't know each other. They're just having this little tit for tat during her character introduction, which I quite enjoyed because, yeah, it makes it feel a little bit more lived in. And we failed to mention, I forget off the top of my head, the name of the actor. I know Steve read it before when he gave the introductions of people. Oh, Gary Sandy.
Gary Sandy.
The one from WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, right. Okay. I've never seen that.
Yeah. And so he plays a character here that they called Duke, who lives in one of the apartment buildings, an apartment that looks like I can only imagine what the interior of Rudyard Kipling's house would look like.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair.
I wanted, maybe you're saving it for later, but I think we definitely have to talk about Phil Fondacaro. And
of course,
I
feel like he was the heart of the story to me, and his character, because I guess he did, you know, the dual roles, but the Malcolm Mallory part as the human, not as the non-troll, the human neighbor, I like cried the first time when he was really emotionally,
really,
captured me.
No, well, I'm totally with you. So we've talked about Fondacaro a lot. He's one of our favorites. So I'm always excited to see him show up. And we're actually running short on Fondacaro movies that are remaining. Like we don't have that many. This is the role, apparently, according to Charles Band's autobiography, this is what this or Dracula from the Creeps are Fondacaro's favorite films that he's ever done. And now he did not want to do this film. He had just finished shooting Return of the Jedi, where he was one of the Ewoks. He had to spend a lot of time in that hot costume. And he's just like, you know what, man, I'm an actor. I would really like to do a role where people can see my face and hear my voice and where I'm not just like a short guy in a costume. And so Charles Band offered him a deal. He said, okay, if you play the troll in this, then I'll also write this other, or I'll have this other character written for you, who is a human character who gets a lot of pathos and a lot of good moments. So we get double the Fondacaro here. He is in costume playing the troll, but he also plays Malcolm Mallory, who is an English professor who lives in the building. He has a terminal disease that he's kind of like just starting to come to grips with. And he befriends the little girl in the building and kind of gets invited to dinner. Now, you can tell that this character was sort of written after the fact because he doesn't really have an impact on the overall plot. It's sort of a little self-contained story in the middle there, but this is my favorite stuff in the movie. He has a monologue where he's talking to the troll. He thinks he's talking to the little girl, but he's talking to the troll. And he's just saying, like, when he found out that he was little and his parents sat him down and told him that you're not going to grow anymore, it's like, I thought for a moment that maybe that means I'm magical. You know, maybe that means I get to be special. My heart swelled a little bit at that, because you have to think that's coming from a real place.
Yeah.
You have to think, like, this guy is accessing a lot of very real pain from his life for this character, but he's bringing in a lot of dignity. He's bringing in a lot of gravitas to this. And I think he's so, so good in this movie.
No, I agree. And I think we often feel like Phil Fondacaro is the heart of the things we talk about. Like, he's kind of slowly became the patron saint of our show.
in the sense that we always
have nothing but nice things to say about him. And we talked when we did the episode on the Creeps about how meaningful it was for him to get the chance to play Dracula in a movie, and how he took it super seriously, even though the tone of the movie didn't always mirror that, just because he thought about how revolutionary it really was for him to be able to play this role. And so that just a lot of love for Phil Fondacaro. I don't think, you know, that's any different than how we've felt about him in the other things. It's like you said, we're running out of stuff to talk about him in, but he is always a high point for us. And one of the things that's new in this movie that I think is really hilarious to talk about is the appearance of Sonny Bono.
Sonny Bono was interesting. I think at this, we're reaching a point where a lot of like younger listeners will really have no idea who Sonny Bono was or why he was important. I believe he died back in 1997, was unfortunately killed in a skiing accident, but he was the longtime husband and partner of Cher. They had a TV show, a sketch, like a variety show back in the 70s that they both got really famous off of. You know, they sang "I've Got You, Babe" together and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then he broke off after they got divorced. He started trying to be an actor. Cher was, let's say, a little more successful at the acting than Sonny Bono was, maybe slightly. But then he segued into politics. He became a congressman in the 90s. I don't really know much about his politics or what he accomplished or if he was a good congressman or not, but I remember it was a big deal that like celebrities are congressmen now, you know? And
he's
here,
having
like,
fun.
Yeah,
he's having fun here. I appreciate just the fact that he is going all in as this sleazy, sort of a ladies' man. It's weird though, because he's getting people, or I say people, I guess I mean person singular, to agree consensually to sleep with him in his apartment, but then very easily toss him aside when he insinuates that she should cook breakfast for him, which is the right thing to do in that situation.
Yeah, the script actually was, I really liked the script of this movie, and his whole part, I was laughing at all the lines that he was trying to put on her, and then she was not going for it.
Yeah.
But I think he also got almost the worst come up. I think he was the worst and skeeviest of the characters, and he got the worst transformation, the most painful looking transformation sequence to me out of all of those. He had the most like balloons all over
Well,
him.
You get a sequence. Like you get a sequence with him. Like with some people, it's kind of like it cuts to them, you know, the ring touching them, and then something else happens. But with him, it's like he's in pain. Then you get a cut where it's bladder effects. You see the arm pulsating. Then it cuts again, and his face basically just turned into Robert Zadar for a second.
Just a moment,
And then it comes back, and he's a pod person.
I think that they purposefully made him look like a phallic-shaped thing for a bit. First, because he was being so horrible and sexist, I think they purposely made him look kind of like a giant green penis thing, and then they turned him into a pod, and I was like,
it's more than kind of.
I appreciate that this movie really sort of hits the ground running. Like, we are engaged in troll mischief within the first like 2 minutes of this movie. Like, the
this
little
thing
girl
moves on a clip.
It does. I mean, the little girl in this movie, the family moves into this apartment building for the first time. The little girl wanders into the basement. She is captured by the troll, who then uses her form. So the little girl, people are very weirdly patient and chill about a little five-year-old girl running around being feral and like growling at people and eating things off the ground. Because like, honestly, if I saw a random five-year-old girl doing that, I wouldn't really think it was weird. You know, I wouldn't think it was that strange. Kids do weird stuff.
All right. I'm pretty sure I've seen people on the streets of New York just screaming about rat burgers before.
Absolutely.
I feel like that just happened. That's just a caution, you know, what happens when you live in a city like this.
And that was before the Rat Burger place even opened up. So, yeah.
I thought it was a couple of funny and weird things about it. Was, first of all, it was really great how they introduced all the characters. I feel like as a script, she pulled the fire alarm, I think, and that made all of the characters have to come downstairs. So immediately, you were very quickly introduced to everybody in one shot. And then the other thing I thought was weird is how everyone seemed fine. Like, these adult guys are fine with like the little girl coming to their apartment and just starts talking to her for a while and not trying to kick her out or being like,
Man, I don't know. I have never lived in like a communal kind of apartment-y space like this. You know, like I've lived in apartment complexes where you fastidiously avoid eye contact with any of your neighbors lest you have to engage with them in some kind of conversation. Like that's kind of my experience of living in an apartment.
I mean, I feel like that's usually the way it is, but this plays out. Yeah. This is like the apartment complex in Rear Window. It's like everyone knows exactly who everyone is and their business of what they got going on.
Exactly.
It's supposed to be San Francisco, right? Was Rear Window also? I can't remember where Rear Window takes place.
Vertigo is San Francisco.
Oh, Vertigo.
Rear Window, I don't. I think Rear Window is New York. It's like I want to say it's New York.
He's like a, I think he's a photographer. He's like a fashion photographer or something. Jimmy Stewart is in that movie. It's been a bit, but
I'm pretty sure it's New York.
Yeah.
But yeah, I enjoy this kind of vibe. I like it when you have like a disparate group of weirdos who just kind of share a roof together. They're all pretty non-judgmental of each other. They all kind of like accept that the other person is weird. Oh yeah, we've got an ancient witch living in here next to the military guy who likes to do wind sprints inside and knock people over. Like, you know, everybody's pretty non-judgmental about everything. They were crazy rude to Malcolm Mallory when he showed up for the first time, but it looks like he took that in stride and they kind of, you know, got over it eventually, but they were being so rude to him. It was making me cringe. But everybody here is a weirdo, and I'm including the parents, Michael Moriarty and Shelley Hack, neither of which get like a lot to do in this movie, especially Shelley Hack. I don't think she really has a whole lot of agency or anything to do, but I think they're both bringing such a weird energy to this part. It's really kind of epitomizing the no small parts, only small actors kind of mentality, because they're bringing something to this that other actors would not have bothered trying.
No, and only a year after this, Shelley Hack would be the mother in The Stepfather.
That's right. Yeah.
To Jill Schoelen.
God, I love that movie. Oh,
one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Michael Moriarty and that Summertime Blues dance sequence.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, it's a family of an apartment building weirdos, and the new family also very weird. But I get the feeling him and his wife, it was kind of indicating they were former hippies. He was a rock record collector, and we're just basically extremely chill about everything that was happening. Very chill.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, Michael Moriarty gets cast as kind of these milquetoast sort of dudes, but he dances like such a free spirit in this movie. He is completely unembarrassed to be doing this very gangly, loose-limbed, improvised dance in his living room. Like, it's a long shot. Like, it's clear that, like, John Carl Beek was just like, all right, man, just go. I'm just going to keep filming until
you're
done.
Getting into Crispin Glover territory is what's happening
here. A little bit,
I'm
going
to put these
things
side by side and see. One, if he really, because, I mean, we all know Crispin Glover was dancing in Friday the 13th, Final Chapter 2, Back in Black.
Which would have made sense for his
movements. It's not what plays on in the movie soundtrack. But I wonder if, I mean, I know Michael Moriarty is kind of lip syncing the words to Summertime Blues, so I feel like he's probably dancing to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's another song.
But yeah, I love seeing that. You don't get enough dance sequences in your fantasy horror movies.
No.
So, you know, and I also loved when Malcolm Mallory was doing the Fairy Queen recitation at the dinner. That sequence where the trolls are awakening and singing in the rescue apartment, that is probably also one of my top favorite parts of the movie. I just loved it.
Okay. That little song was that was the sequence that stuck with me the most. Like on the second viewing, I'm like, all right, I mostly only remember this singing sequence because it's so strange. It feels like it's out of nowhere. It's staged in such a weird kind of Sesame Street-ish kind of way. The puppets look their shoddiest in this moment. I think for the most part, the special effects in this are pretty good, but they're definitely breaking out a couple of reject puppets just to kind of round out the roster. Some of them have like some like loose flaps around their mouth, or like you could see a palm inside a mouth, you know?
Yeah, it's like the Gremlins Christmas caroling scene where it's like they got a couple of the main Gremlins front and center. And if you really look in the background, you might see, you know, a couple of half finished puppets with their mouths, you know, kind of static open.
But they're singing this bizarre, like nonsensical language. Like some of the trolls' mouths are moving, some of them aren't, but they're all implied to be singing. And it's this strange song that goes on for a really long time. And it's in conjunction with Fonda Caro like reciting this very kind of stately and lovely story, you know. So it's a very interesting decision.
Yeah, and I think Richard Band borrowed a little bit from himself in terms of what he had composed for the main theme of Ghoulies. It definitely hit again here, very similar in spirit to that one. But I think the difference between this and Ghoulies, and sorry, Doug McCambridge, I'm going to offend you here. This is, I think, a better movie than Ghoulies.
I agree.
And I think this has, the cast in this movie is really really game and everyone's bringing it. But what I like about, like, so that moment in the movie, I think, is so fitting, because I think taking this in the direction of a PG-13 fantasy helped it. Because this was originally, when this was conceived, it was conceived originally by Ed Naha, who was the screenwriter. And it was supposed to be pitched to Roger Corman's production company. And it was supposed to be titled Goblin, which is kind of funny because it even makes it more why Troll 2 would be a sequel to this movie, and why I feel like when the director in Best Worst Movie, when the director of Troll 2 is asked why there's no trolls in the movie, and he has some kind of hilarious response to that. I think that movie is a sequel to a Goblin movie, and this was almost called Goblin, but this was supposed to be an R-rated movie, and what it was supposed to take place instead of in an apartment building, in a motel. And basically, the troll would take over the body of a young girl, which they does here, our little Carol Ann stand-in here.
Very similar Carol Ann,
go around from room to room and then just murder everyone.
Yeah.
And so here, they took a little bit of an approach. And this, a lot, the time with Roger Corman at the time was really turbulent. And he wasn't with New World anymore. He had a new company. And I think Beekler decided that him and Ed Naha wanted to take this to Charlie Band at this time because Empire was new and they could probably get this thing greenlit and off the ground, I would say. But I do think, like, one of the caveats that Charlie Band had was, let's kind of change this up a little bit from this really ultra-violent, scary, horror-forward, R-rated thing that you have, and turn it into a more family-friendly fantasy movie. And so that's really what they did here. And I think it's for the better. I think this movie would be hurt by a more serious tone.
I think so.
And I think similar to Terror Vision, although I do think Terror Vision being a horror comedy has more, well, maybe not. I think maybe there's the equal amount of horrific elements to this movie, but I find them, it's sort of not surprising that they were being produced at the same time, because there's a lot of similarities, I think, in tone and design. Like Sonny Bono's apartment, which, I love what he did with the place. That racing stripe, I feel, is pretty neat, or pretty sharp.
Makes it go faster.
It looks like it was set designed similarly to the mansion in Terror Vision.
It does a bit, yeah. Well, I was going to say, too, like, I'd always just thought that with Troll 2, like, attaching a troll license to it was very arbitrary, because they wanted, when that movie was being released, I think the American distributors knew that that movie was kind of a stinker, but they wanted to make a little bit of money off it. So they're like, all right, what's the cheapest profitable movie that we could attach this to that would make sense? Trolls available? Okay, let's grab it and call this Troll 2. It doesn't matter that there's no trolls in here. But there are more parallels between Troll 1 and Troll 2 than I remembered. Like the way that the troll turns everybody into vegetation is consistent across both creatures here.
Very true.
The witches that can turn young, like there's a lot of, and even some of the designs of the little monsters are similar. Granted, the ones in Troll 2 definitely look like third-rate Halloween store, like, knockoffs with burlap sacks, running around. You can see mouth movement behind the masks. But there are more parallels than I would have thought. Like, I'm still not saying this is the most thought-out decision or anything. I think this was a choice to just get the thing out the door. Also, I was not aware there's a Troll 3. Similarly unrelated to the other two movies, but there is a Troll 3 that I've never seen before. I don't know. Are you familiar with that one?
I am not. I mean, it's funny because Troll 2, as we all know, had a lot of notoriety. Probably, when that documentary Best Worst Movie came out, I think it brought a lot of notoriety. So I actually saw Troll 2 before I saw Troll, and I had been aware of it. Like, I had seen scenes of it on TV in the past, kind of go by when I was a kid. And I just I think I saw the part where Julia Louis-Dreyfus turned into a nymph. And I was like thinking, huh, that's interesting. But I just didn't seek it out. And then I only sought it out a couple of years ago to be like, I'm going to finally watch Troll. And I was just so blown away about how much I loved it that I had to that, like, I shared it. I did a couple of viewings with friends afterwards, and I spread the word.
Yeah.
I do that sometimes when there's a movie that really strikes me, and Troll is one of them where I was like, have you seen this? Like, have you, if you've not seen it, I need to show you this because it is really giving me joy.
It's fun. Yeah, absolutely. Fun. It is definitely falling into that Gremlins knockoff space in a way that we thought Ghoulies was going to, and then really, really didn't. This one does scratch that kind of like Gremlins knockoff itch more so than the Ghoulies would, but it is more spirited, more funny, more fun, more self-aware than I think a lot of other movies of this era are. I think it's got a winking sense of humor. It's got a nice sense of mischief to it. And I think the cast is so good and everybody's like committing to their bit and bringing something interesting to their characters that this movie jumped up like two or three stars for me on this second viewing. I mean, it was kind of indifferent to the first time. And now I'm like, is this secretly like really good?
Well, see, Steve, I kind of am going to echo what you're saying here, because when I think back to when I first saw this movie, and I could tell you that it was in the wake of the popularity of the first Leprechaun movie,
yeah,
hitting home video.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
what happened was me and friends would go and rent movies, and it's like, okay, well, this movie Leprechaun is out, you know, and I think it seemed like a novel concept at the time, I guess. And we were like, all right, cool, like Leprechaun, that's neat. And I feel like in our walking the aisles of the video store, we saw the box of Troll, and I think we thought it was going to be like Leprechaun in spirit and tone.
Yeah.
And I mean, it sort of is in some ways, because like, although you can't really have ever predicted where the Leprechaun series was going to go, the first movie is very pretty campy. Like, it's not like it's this dark, brooding, serious horror movie, and then he goes into space and the hood and all of these other places.
Right.
But
it was always silly, yeah.
Right, and I remember watching Troll as a companion piece. Then years later, when Troll 2 started to become popular among like bad movie circuits, like via The Room and all of those kinds of things, and Best Worst Movie was coming out, I remember, like, I guess having seen Troll 2 at that point, but not really remembering a lot about Troll 1, and then going back and watching Troll 1 and realizing that it was as much of a fantasy as it is, and is as comedic as it is.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, no, that's actually like, that's a fun little B movie. It's not trying to be Leprechaun. It's not trying to be scary, but there's stuff about it that works. And I'm going to say that this might've been my third viewing of the movie.
Okay.
And I immediately gravitated towards things, and I had a weird memory, a suppressed memory that was unlocked. Definitely there was a short period of time where the phrase rat burgers being yelled was definitely quoted by people in my friend group.
Okay.
Like we definitely picked it up and would use it, and then it kind of fell out of favor with us, or we forgot about it, because when that started happening, I immediately started laughing, and I'm like, oh my god, I remember this. And like the musical number too, with the singing, same thing.
Yeah.
Once that started in that theme, because I think, you know, I went back and I listened to Richard Band's main theme from this movie. I layered it over an Instagram post I did recently for the show. And I'm like, man, I really remember this theme. Like it's memorable, but I wasn't in my brain putting it over the scene where it plays. And it just kind of came back, and I'm like, oh no, I remember this. This is really fun. And then I'm watching it cut back to it, and these characters pop out of the woods. And I think this is low key one of the stronger Empire movies. And the thing is, I just think when it came out, like, I don't want to heap like superlative praise on it, because it's a B movie and there's aspects of it that are shoddy in some ways for sure. But there's, I don't know if the timing of Empire coming out with a lot of these B movies around the time that the country and film criticism writ large was just over, having to review horror movie after horror movie after horror movie. But I feel like the critics were really dismissive of this movie without really even making an attempt to kind of get it. Like, I think it was just one or two critics were like, there's a lot to enjoy here in this B movie. And everyone else seemed to just be like, this is trash. don't waste your time. I don't really think people, kind of similarly to Terrorvision, I just don't think people were in on the joke. Like, I don't think people understood the level of self-aware that the filmmakers were making.
Or there's
this.
There's just an assumption that, like, if you're making this movie, you're stupid, you know? And we've spoken to so many people who've been involved with the making of these movies, and they are absolutely not stupid. They absolutely know what movie they were making. They knew why they were making it. And you have to take each movie on its own ground. You know, you have to decide, is it successful at what it was trying to do? Did it resonate? You know, was it made in good faith and with good intentions? You know, and then take it on its own terms. No, are you going to put this against, you know, Amistad or something, and they like talk about it in the same way? No, obviously not. But you know, if you meet it on its level, and you know, take a little time with it, because yeah, you're exactly right. There was just this glut of horror movies, so much so that film critics just stopped engaging with them entirely.
And also, I mean, but fantasy stuff too, because I mean, if you look at stuff, there was a lot of stuff coming out that time, like Crawl and Ice Pirates, and then obviously Neverending Story, which maybe will offend some listeners by saying this is a movie that I don't like. It's kind of a nostalgia buster for me. I loved it as a kid, watched it throughout adulthood, and realized I actually don't like it. And you know, that's the opinion I've had of the movie for probably the last 20-ish years. And there was a lot of other fantasy stuff coming out around the same time. Dark Crystal, the fantasy element of Return of the Jedi, and all of that. And Ed Naha himself had written what would become a movie that he ended up taking his name off of, called Wizards of the Lost Kingdom.
Oh, okay.
If you've ever seen the newer Mystery Science Theater return on Netflix in that first revival season, they covered the first two movies in it, and that is just incomprehensible.
Is that
nonsense.
Like an Ator movie or something? Like the Ator the Barbarian, or
no? They watch Ator the Flying Eagle in season also. This is just one where there's a guy called like a Galifax or something, and he's like a big Yeti who follows a kid around. Like
Oh yes. Oh my god, that one was so good.
Nonsense. Great Mystery Science Theater episode, by the way.
Yeah, that was so good.
But yeah, no, he took his name off of that movie. He wanted nothing to do with it. But I think it was that perfect storm of just horror movies ruled the box office for a handful of years. Critics really fought back. Fantasy stuff also was kind of being churned out at the time too. And I genuinely feel like snobby critics, and I say that meaning like, not necessarily every critic was a snob, but I think like there was an attitude towards genre cinema in general at the time, where it's just like this thing never had a chance to catch on really with an audience. But luckily, despite, you know, making a little bit of money back, I think a 1-point-something million budget and 5.5 million box office or something like that. This wasn't the hit Ghoulies was in its limited theatrical run. It killed on video.
That's the Empire model right there. Is just, you know, small theatrical run, make your money back, and then VHS run where you just absolutely dominate. And this was definitely the case with that. I don't know. I'm curious what you guys said. And Abby, you're an artist too, so you can weigh in a little bit. I think something that this movie is definitely lacking from a video store perspective is the cover of the Ghoulies. You know, like this is something Ghoulies has over Troll any day of the week, right?
Yeah,
like,
no toilet in this one.
Yeah, the design of the Troll poster is nothing exciting.
But did you see that Easter egg where that toilet ghoulie is in the painting on the wall of the witch behind her?
Yeah. That's,
I'm calling it the toilet ghoulie. I'm sure there's is it called like the wet? They have different nicknames.
Fish ghoulie.
Fish Ghoulie
is his name.
They are like genuinely kind of uninspired names for the Ghoulies. Yeah, it's like Fish Ghoulie, Bat Ghoulie, Perry Ghoulie. Yeah, you know.
Although Fish Ghoulie, Fish Ghoulie looks like the toilet ghoulie, but I actually would have to look. I think there might be a differentiation between the two. I know that Fish Ghoulie has that same kind of design as the toilet ghoulie. But I forget exactly. Really, I'm really letting down our listener base right now.
Oh, man, we are stoking the most that we've gotten so far is just that we are not fans of Ghoulies, which is a big one for a lot of people, I think.
Doug, put your phone down.
The creatures are amazing. First of all, I really love the creatures in this. And I also I've seen Ghoulies and Ghoulies too. I believe I, you know, prefer Ghoulies too a bit, but
I do like
creatures. And I think they probably might have used some of the same creatures in some of the group scenes.
Yeah,
but I just really love those designs, and I'm a cat lover and a cat, you know, owner. And I do feel the sounds of some of the Ghoulies are similar to some of the sounds like a pet, like a cat or dog might make when they're making kind of funny gurgly sounds. Cause animals, your pets, cats are little gremlins. They can be like little gremlins too. And sometimes they make weird noises like that you hear the trolls and the Ghoulies make. And I find it very endearing. So I actually find the troll characters all very endearing. I have to shout out Galwin, the mushroom troll.
Yes.
Is the best, my favorite. Loved him. I fell in love with him, and I actually made a plushie out of him because I love that character so much. He was so cute, but yet grotesque at the same time.
And we should mention we can see Abby's cat on screen, and it looks kind of like a small rubber Phil Fondacaro. So I understand why you really relate to the creatures in this movie.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say too, I really want to emphasize about the Malcolm Mallory character and how his character really resonated emotionally through the screen for me very well. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible to me to have a movie where you have something like that. And then, you know, the humorous antics of creepy Sonny Bono up against, there's a magical witch who has got a mushroom and she is like giving a hard time to the teenage kid who keeps on trying to get in her apartment because he wants to hang out with her. And she's like, what are you doing, kid?
Yeah.
There's a real kitchen sink approach to movie making here, which I like. There's just a lot of choices being made. I mean, we didn't really talk much. I made one kind of joke earlier about Duke's apartment. But it's like just even the and I love his character introduction too, which is basically like, you're a bleeding heart liberal if you read books.
Yeah, right. That was insane.
Which is true.
Yes. Put those books down, listeners.
Yeah.
Well, you could tell like the first villains that get taken out, the first neighbors get taken out is like the creepy male chauvinist Sonny Bono and then the ultra right wing.
Yeah, you work your way up to the innocents. Like Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her boyfriend are innocent, really. They're just normal people living in the apartment, you know. And then the
girl has principles, man.
Yeah. You know, so you have to appreciate it. I mean, I don't know. I was just right in the right headspace for this movie. I had such a good time with it. I really would kind of recommend checking it out and giving it a viewing. Like, it's worth watching independently of Troll 2. I'd always just sort of written it off as like, yeah, it's just kind of like Troll 2, but competent, you know. But like, it's more than that, I think. It's got some interesting stuff. It has a genuinely affecting performance, some genuinely funny choices, and a couple of great special effects bits. I think it's a winner. I really like
it. I would have liked to have seen this movie. Now, I understand that it shares a lot more tonally and design-wise, aesthetically, with Ghoulies.
Yeah.
I would have liked this to have been in Empire of Screams. Like, I'm just picturing, like, what the cool Arrow Video artwork for this would have been. Like,
yeah.
I would have liked to have seen, you know, Heather Buckley produce some supplemental footage about this.
Hey, there's always time for another box set. There's plenty of movies out there still.
Yeah.
Bring back Eliminators. Make that easier to find.
Yeah. I feel like every make that one easier to find. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think the more I look at a lot of these Empire movies, like, you know, when it's funny because when we give people a postcard for the show or we describe what the show is, I feel like instinctively we lean towards like, oh, it's a Full Moon Features podcast because Full Moon has taken up so much of the time of the last 35 years, essentially, of Charles Band's career.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we obviously cover, and actually this episode is coming sort of right at the front end of what's going to be a bunch of weeks in a row of Empire movies.
Yeah, we're in a real run. Yeah.
We're in an Empire run here, listeners. So just know that just stuff that's going to be coming up over the next few weeks is going to be heavily Empire. Not because we chose it that way. It's just because of people wanting to do certain episodes and the way that the spreadsheet went is more of a coincidence than anything. But I've really been fond of the way that these Empire movies have just, they fall less and less into identifiable singular genres. I mean, I guess you could say in Full Moon, there's a lot of that too. I mean, you have your Evil Bong and Ginger Dead Man, which are just like a killer implement type thing. And you have your subspecies, which is a cool but kind of straightforward vampire story. All of these Empire movies that came out, and they came out in a short window of time. You're really talking from like Dungeon Master in like, you know, 84 to then when, you know, I mean, Robot Jocks and Arena weren't released while Empire was still functioning, but to 88, essentially, like in a 4-year-ish span, these movies are so drastically different from one another.
Yeah.
And they're all like these kind of oddball ideas given really interesting treatment and being worked on by a lot of the same people. So it's like, I almost want to look, like you look at a list of Empire movies and it's almost like, I want 6 Empire of Screens box set.
Yeah, that's why I want one. I want one a year.
Every
man.
Single one remastered, every movie remastered with a book and special features, because I've just been really fond of them. What's that again?
So if they keep making them, I'll keep buying them. I don't care what you put it in. Yeah, I'll keep buying them. They're great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking ahead to stuff that's coming up on the show in the near future. Yeah. And it's like, we've got your like Zone Troopers coming in the reasonably near future. We've got Vicious Lips coming real soon.
Oh, wow.
and these movies, like, if nothing else, it's just, they're just taking these wild swings. And it's like crazy to me that in the same year, the same company was putting out From Beyond, but also putting out Troll, but also letting Albert Pyun put out Vicious Lips. And I love all of it so much. And I've just grown to appreciate seeing each person's little stamp on these things and what this company was doing, and just largely dismissed by the mainstream public at the time. And it's just one of the real pleasures of doing the show is going back and watching stuff like this. And I find this to be in the upper echelon of Empire stuff for sure.
Well, you gave me
go ahead.
So you gave me a really good idea, or this is a suggestion, whoever puts out the next special edition of Troll. You might have remembered the opening of Troll has a fairy tale book, and it has really nicely illustrated watercolors. It's like a illuminated manuscript almost.
Yeah.
Somebody should make a really beautiful Troll box set with an illustrated illuminated manuscript booklet that you could open, because there are some really nice illustrations, including the one with that toilet ghoulie popping up behind her head, which is on the wall. But again, since I'm a cartoonist, I definitely noticed all that, and also that she was illustrating these things in, like, that's what she was busy doing. Is she was the witch Eunice St. Clair was living her best life, being an illustrator, illustrating manuscripts up in her awesome apartment when the teenage boy comes up to bother her. And she, something that made me laugh that she said is that I think he asked her what she was doing, and she was like, "What do you do?" She goes, "Anything I damn well please." I said, "This is aspirational."
Yeah.
For everybody, but especially for women of a certain age, this is where you want to be.
Absolutely.
When you're retired, this is it.
Absolutely. And she dresses kind of like the brothel owner from that Simpsons episode.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. The Maison Derrière. Not the brothel, it's a burlesque.
She puts the spring in Springfield.
She does. She absolutely does. I'm going to end today with a complete non sequitur. The three movies that Julia Louis-Dreyfus was in 1986 were Troll, Hannah and Her Sisters, and Soul Man. So that is a wild and varied year. Three movies that
Troll
definitely
is somehow, you know, she might want Troll, the blemish of Troll taken away from her, but somehow the least problematic of those three.
I was going to say, look, Hannah and Her Sisters, objectively the best movie of those three. Troll 2, probably the
great
least
movie.
Problematic one. Yeah. Yeah. So, or Troll 1, excuse me, probably the least problematic. Abby, thank you so much for being here with us and for sharing your expertise. And people couldn't see, you have some amazing plushies of, like, homemade plushies of the Galvin from Troll, or Galwin, excuse me, from Troll. And he's incredible.
I'll have to post it on my Instagram. So
Where can people find your stuff, your art, your amazing graphic novels, all of these things that you do?
So my website is abbydenson.com. That's ABBYDENSON.com. And then same with my, I say go to my Instagram, which is just Abby Denson. So at Abby Denson. And I don't think I've ever even shared a photo of Galwin before. So I will do it. I'll share it when this is posted so people can see it. And then you can share.
It's so cool. You shared a preview copy of one of your graphic novels with us, and it is so adorable and so fun. Can you tell folks about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I did the graphic novel series Kitty Sweet Tooth, where I scripted that one. It's illustrated by the amazing Japan-based artist Uemaru. And it's about a cat who loves B-movies and desserts. And in the first book, she manages a movie theater where she screens movies and makes magical food with a witch and a not mad scientist and brings a community of movie lovers together. And it does have
love that so much.
Thank you. It's autobiographical, semi-autobiographical. It's a purple cat. Actually, it's my fantasy of what I could do. And the second, the first book is about loving B movies and bringing your community together. The second book is Kitty Sweet Tooth Makes a Movie, where she becomes a director and goes on all kinds of adventures. And it has like a transforming vehicle that helps. That's like a transforming studio where they can go into space, go underwater. I mean, I'm sure every director wishes they had this, but this is my fantasy world, so I could do what I want. And then aside from that, I have three books out about Japan that I have drawn and that I have written: Cool Japan Guide, Cool Tokyo Guide, and Uniquely Japan.
Amazing. Seriously, these graphic novels, if you're a fan of our show and have young kids, this is the perfect cross-section for you. The Venn diagram overlaps exactly where Kitty Sweet Tooth lives, and it's really cute and really funny. I enjoyed it a lot. So thank you for sharing that with us, and thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I loved it, and I'm a fan, so keep it up.
Oh, thank you. And no, yeah, listeners, you will, of course, love that. I have no doubt in my mind about that. But if you like what we do, then jump on to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and drop us a quick 5-star rating and maybe a short review if you feel so inclined. If you want to follow the show on social media, like if you just found us and you want to see where you can get little glimpses of what we're up to, posting some stuff, you can find us on Instagram at puppetmasters_castlefreaks. You can follow me at _giallo_jerry or Steve at @MinotaurMatador. We are also on X, Threads, Blue Sky, YouTube, anywhere else really on social media. If you just search the name of the podcast, you will be able to find us. But we are not the only podcast where you can find Steve. So Steve, where else can people find you if they want to hear more of your voice?
Well, you can find me at Cinemarcade. That's cinema and arcade mashed together. It's a show about movies and video games and the sparks that fly when those two worlds collide. We watch a movie, we play the video game adaptation of it, and then we compare and contrast and see how they complement or take away from each other. This week we're going to be doing, I'm not sure where we are in the schedule with Puppet Masters Castle Freaks. I'm going to be this week recording an episode on The Last Starfighter. That's the next one coming up, which is a movie I'm excited to revisit. And then we've got stuff coming up about Scott Pilgrim and Power Rangers and a bunch of other things coming up. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Cool. And there's no confusion about next week's episode for us, though. And we've got a fun one on the docket. Steve, what are we got coming next week?
Oh, well, we have a really fun one. We mentioned it earlier, but we're going to talk about the movie Vicious Lips, a movie I really don't know anything about, but I'm excited to get into this. I hear this is
as you should be
for a lot of people. I know it's an Albert Pune, and I always have a good time with a punitive production. So I'm ready for it.
Well said. So, everybody, we will see you next week for Vicious Lips. So stay tuned, and thank you again to Abby Denson for joining us. See you next time.